their burdens. Select a few readings for the weekend. In the syllabus, there are three sessions that are kind of grouped together as 29A, B, and C, I think, under Socialism and Real Utopias. As a whole, that includes quite a lot of reading. But I'll take a parsimonious selection. I think it'll be mainly a couple of chapters from the Real Utopias book will probably be the most useful things to read for our weekend discussion. And I'll prepare this nice, clear memo, which I'll send out to everybody this evening. Okay. What I'd like to review in today's session and on Wednesday is some alternatives, an alternative approach to the problem of thinking about the trajectory of capitalist development. Given that the classic story of the destiny of capitalism that we've just reviewed doesn't seem satisfactory. The most interesting account that I know of the trajectory of capitalist development is Giovanni Arrighi's, his book, The Long 20th Century. The revised edition of it is not yet available, unfortunately. When it is available, I would encourage you to get it because it's definitely worth having in your long-term libraries. But I have included on the library reserves, there are selected chapters from the older edition of the book. Arrighi's approach is particularly relevant, I think, for trying to locate the current kinds of crises we're in, why, you know, this particular period of uncertainty that we're in, within a very long trajectory of capitalist development. Arrighi is one of the few theorists of capitalist development who predicted this kind of great financial crisis for a long time. I mean, you know, I spoke to him 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even less, 3 or 4 years ago, about these themes. And if anything, his puzzle was why it's taking so long. You know, he had been predicting a major financial crisis of global capitalism for, you know, 10 or 15 years. He thought the Asian financial crisis of 97 was just a warm-up for something bigger, and he was surprised at how long it was taking. But that's the only surprise. He felt that this was an inherent feature of the nature of this phase of capitalist development, that it would produce these kinds of crises. So we'll look at how Arrighi approaches this problem, and in particular, how he embeds this in a very long-term trajectory view of capitalist development. One of the hallmarks of Arrighi's view, though, is he does not have a determinate destination. He doesn't attempt a prediction as to where this is all going in the long, you know, in the end. There's no destination. But he does have a particular view of these long cycles and how they have a particular character to them. But before we look at Arrighi, I thought it would be good to make a few comments about an earlier paper that I wrote on the question of capitalist crisis tendencies and how to think about them. So in the classical story, the importance of crisis was that understanding the tendency towards crisis in capitalism gave us the raw materials for understanding the intensification of crisis in capitalism. The real payoff for Marx was not just the theory of business cycles, why you would have instability, although he had very interesting things to say about that problem. But rather, the real payoff for Marx was to have a theory of crisis that would actually give you amplitudes and give you a directionality to the intensity of crisis. That's what he was trying to do. And that's the part of the theory that seems to be the most vulnerable. We don't have any good grounds for that projection into the future. Nevertheless, we have raw materials for a theory of crisis in capitalism, of crises in the plural in capitalism. And when I wrote about this in the 1970s, I was trying to make sense of the many debates that were existing at that time among Marxist political economists about what the underlying explanations for the tendency towards crisis were in capitalism. And I proposed a kind of general way of thinking about this. And even though my particular, if you will, orchestration of this schema, the particular way I played it out, I don't think is probably defendable. That is, I made some particular claims about the sequencing of these crisis tendencies and where we were at that time. This was the mid-1970s, or 1974, I guess, where we were on this sequence. Those particular explanations, I don't think, shall we say, have withstood the test of time. I think the way I approach the problem has some instructive character to it. So here's basically the way I approached, here was my essential argument. And this can be, I think, usefully described as a dialectical argument in the sense that it provides a reason for understanding after the fact why historical development moves through various kinds of stages, even if it's unable to predict ahead of the fact. It's more like the dialectics of an evolutionary argument than of a predictive argument. So here's basically how the analysis works. At each stage of capitalist development, there is a distinctive constraint on continued capital accumulation. So under different conditions, capitalism encounters different constraints on successive accumulation. Capitalism encounters constraints on capital accumulation. As accumulation continues, and as those constraints are encountered, they become fetters on continued capitalist development. So the claim here is that a constraint on capitalist development, something which blocks further accumulation, doesn't simply dissolve in the face of whatever problems it encounters. Those constraints persist unless action is taken to transform the constraint itself. A constraint counts as a constraint because it needs changing in order for capital accumulation to increase. Let me give an example of what I'm talking about and how you can give some specificity to this idea. So if you're a capitalist and you're engaged in some production process, you may encounter a technological constraint on continued production. Let's suppose you're in mining and you've exhausted the coal that's easily accessible on the surface and you have to dig down into a mountain in order to get more coal. And you want to do this, but you have problems because the mines keep filling up with water as you dig down. Now, you can say this is a kind of trivial point. Unless you solve that problem, you can't accumulate capital through that coal mining. There is a constraint, in this case a natural constraint, that has to be transformed in order to continue mining the coal. So you have to figure out how to pump the water out. So this is a simple technological example which says that we have a technical obstacle to continued production. The mine fills up with water. Unless we find a solution, we can't accumulate capital in this way any longer. We can't extract the coal and exploit the miners. Once we figure out how to pump effectively water out of mines, this opens up the possibility of continued accumulation, getting deeper and deeper into the coal field in this case. Now, the idea that there are technological constraints to continued accumulation in various areas is a simple one. And it's one of the reasons why, in fact, capitalism is so innovative. You know, capitalism is a system in which, because of the pressures of competition, capitalists have huge incentives to individually try to solve these kinds of technical obstacles. And capitalism has done a good job at that. You know, that's why it's such a dynamic, revolutionary mode of production with respect to developing technology. When technological problems are encountered in production, which act as obstructions to further accumulation, capitalism has proved pretty clever at being able to figure out new ways of doing things. The social argument is that capitalism also encounters social relational obstacles to accumulation, not just technical obstacles. And these turn out to be often harder to solve, in part because they require collective coordinated action. Sometimes individual capitalists can solve social obstacles to accumulation, but more often social obstacles to continued accumulation require new institutions of one sort or another. The trajectory of capitalist development, therefore, can be mapped by looking at, for any given phase of capitalist development, what are the obstacles which get encountered, and how do those obstacles get unblocked. If it turns out to be difficult to unblock the obstacle, the symptom is typically crisis. A crisis occurs when there is a serious obstacle to continued accumulation, and it turns out to be difficult to remove the obstacle. The difficulty of removing the obstacle, the symptom of that is that the obstacle stays in place and capital accumulation becomes more and more problematic. And what does more and more problematic mean? It means things like firms go bankrupt, unemployment increases, rates of profit are called into question. Crises, therefore, of different intensities and disruption occur periodically in response to obstacles that are encountered. Crises set in motion a search for structural solutions. That is, a crisis is a motivator. A crisis tells people something isn't working well, something has to change, and people, whether they be policy experts or individual capitalists attempting to figure out how to survive in the face of these obstacles, energy gets placed, set into motion in the search for new structural solutions. Now, when you have a crisis and you have structural solutions that need to be found in order to get out of the crisis, different groups of capitalists will be trying to figure out what kinds of solutions are best for them, right? So, you know, there's no kind of simple knowing in advance. If we have a new structure of accumulation which gets set in place in the face of this crisis, who are going to be the winners and who are going to be the losers? Different institutional innovations will advantage some groups of capitalists over others. What this means is that the search for solutions takes the